Welcome to the Rata Dojo with your host, Steve Diamond.
Why, Johnny Ringo, you look like somebody just walked over your grave.
And Larry Korea.
From now on, I see a red sash, I kill the man wearing it. So run, you cur, and tell the other curs the law is coming. You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Today's episode, Supporter Spectacular number 12.
Welcome, everybody, to the Rider Dojo. Glad to have you all back with us today.
I got a little exuberant on that
one. Yeah, it's fine. I mean, it's Tombstone, right? Like
it woke Steve's dog up.
Yeah. They got home. They got excited. They're like, "What the crap is going on?" All right. So it's been a minute since we've done a Q&A, Larry, and we have some pretty interesting questions. And so, not a ton, but I think that each of these questions is going to require a little bit more analysis, more than like just our typical. Write better, noob.
Well, some of the questions people ask us sometimes are kind of no-brainers.
Yeah.
You know, and they just sometimes people who know the answer, they just need reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And other times there are difficult questions, and we got some good ones today,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. All right. This one is from supporter Kip. He says, the question is, how do you learn to write something out of your bailiwick? So he talks about one of our previous horror episodes that we did. We do several because, have you met me?
Yeah.
Drink. Yeah. And he says he had an idea for a horror short story, but he's not really a horror person and doesn't typically read it or watch it. And he says, keeping that in mind, and keeping in mind that both of you, meaning me and you, Larry, have many experiences writing outside of your comfort zone, I would like to hear how you learned to do it or what worked to help you do it. I know from listening that Steve used to write up the RPG sessions in different genres. So this would be one of the examples. But if there are other examples like rewriting a show dialogue or something crazy, I would like to hear it. So the idea, Larry, is... when you and I both started writing in our various times, we wrote one thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And we're both multi-genre now.
Yeah. Very multi-genre. And it's intentional.
Yeah. Yeah. I very specifically set out at the beginning to not just be the monster guy and try to write other stuff other than just, you know, Monster Hunter International. If to answer that question, I don't know if I have a good... clear-cut answer. I like to look at it as like a series of personal challenges, right, to myself. If I see something that looks interesting to me, I decide I want to take a shot at it. And the way I'm wired personality-wise is if I'm going to do something, I want to be good at it. Like, I'm not the guy that can just be a casual video gamer. You know what I mean? Like, I have to be good at it or it's crap and I don't ever want to play it again. I can't just shoot guns for fun. I have to, like, be world class or I'm garbage. You know what I mean? So anything I get into, I kind of want to like really go for it. So for me, it's I see a genre and it looks cool. It looks interesting and I want to play in it. I want to dabble in it, but then I'll give it my best effort. Mm-hmm. Like I will usually think really hard about like how that genre works. How is it structured? What is it that I like about it? Like, so I don't do a lot of horror, but I've done some and I've actually done pretty good at it. I did one that was very Lovecraftian horror.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And before I did that, I read a bunch of Lovecraft and just kind of like tried to get in that like proper mindset before tackling that story. I don't know if there's a good pat answer for that.
I think there are a lot of answers for this.
Yeah, I think it's going to depend on your personal psychology.
So I remember, Larry, back in ye olden days, this would have been 11 years ago at this point. Maybe longer, maybe more like 12. You were about to start writing Son of the Black Sword. And
which at the time was a totally different genre for me.
Very different genre. And you came to me and you said, Steve, I'm gonna be writing kind of dark epic fantasy, but with a heroic angle, more or less.
Yeah, and I had a lot of Robert E. Howard influence on me at that point too. So very it kind of went down that road.
Yeah, and at the time I was still running Elitist Book Reviews.
So you had read a lot
of
this genre.
And so you're like, hey, Steve, give me recommendations. What books can I read that will help me kind of understand more or less what it is this whole fantasy gig is about these days.
Yeah, you gave me Joe Abercrombie.
I gave you
Mark Lawrence.
Yeah, Joe Abercrombie, Mark Lawrence, and I also gave you the first Erickson book. Though I remember warning you at the time. I'm like, yeah,
I didn't get super into that one either.
Well, the first book, Gardens of the Moon, is so hard to get into.
Yeah, it's I love it. A lot of people told me it's really good, but it's long haul, and he doesn't hold your hand at any point. But I like Lawrence, and I liked Abercrombie, and so it was good to just kind of get a little refresher of what's going on in that genre right now.
And I remember when I read the draft of Son of the Black Sword, I remember thinking very distinctly. I'm like, okay, he obviously read some Joe Abercrombie I'm seeing that here. I'm seeing the Mark Lawrence here.
Well, I hadn't
before you hadn't. And so I'm like, okay, I'm seeing some of that here, but I was also seeing, because if we're all being real here, both Abercrombie and Lawrence, especially in the first books in their series, delve very, very far into the grimdark, thing. And I don't think that's what you write, Larry.
No, that's not how I'm naturally wired.
When I was reading it, I thought, oh, okay, he took that stuff, but there's also some Gemmell in here. There's heroic fantasy. There's Robert E. Howard. There's heroics in here.
Yeah. And so I think part of it, when you're straying into other genres, I would say read what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I'm finishing up the final book of Son of the Black Sword right now, the saga, I forgot. I'm almost done. And the only question is it going to be one book or two? Yeah. It might be getting cut in half because it's gotten really fat. And I'm not done yet. But it's got to be done soon. But when I'm working on this stuff, when I'm going to a different genre, I will get suggestions from people who are really familiar with it. Like, I'm doing a progression fantasy next because that's a new thing I wanted to tackle.
And that was what I was going to ask you. Have you been getting recommendations?
Yeah, I've actually got a list.
Okay.
That I have not read any of them yet.
Mm-hmm.
So this is more something that I know what the genre is about, and it sounds really interesting to me, and I have a story that I think would fit that really well. But I am not well read on what's popular in it at all. And so I do is going to be my own take on it.
And, you know, I actually think that in some aspects of it, like, I think there's two sides to this. One, I do think, and this is my personal opinion, if you are going to write something within a certain genre, so to speak, you know, progression fantasy for you, right? For me, giant robots, science fiction, right? I do think that going out and consuming some of that media so that you understand what some of the conventions are within it that you can play with is good.
Yeah.
However, I do also think
there's a danger.
There's a danger of becoming too derivative.
Yeah, you don't ever want to be derivative.
But here's the thing. I do think that being a little divorced from that genre is just fine.
No, I actually think that's a plus.
Exactly.
Because how else can you have a fresh perspective?
That's exactly my point.
Because think about it, when I started out writing urban fantasy, I hadn't read any urban fantasy, hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I'm best known for because I came in and I had a different perspective on it. There's a lot of genres that I've messed with that I don't really have a lot of background in. And there's others that I do. Basically, don't let your lack of knowledge hold you back, and don't let too much knowledge screw you up.
This is, I always come back to the Joe Lansdale quote, which I've used a million times on this show, but I'm going to say it again because I love Joe Lansdale.
He's a brilliant dude.
And he said once, he said, you know, I don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to write a crime story today. I'm going to write a horror story today. I'm not going to write a period piece today. He said, I'm going to write a Joe Lansdale story today. So whatever the genre is, Kip, and for all the other listeners out there, that doesn't matter as much. I mean, obviously you can go out, you can do some research, and that'll help you, but don't get so lost within it that you lose the uniqueness that is you within it.
Yeah. Like there's kind of a subcategory at this point. I've been doing this long enough of Larry Correa novels. There are certain things that my fans expect from Larry Correa novels. They're things that probably, even if I tried not to do them, I would probably do them anyway, just because that's how I'm wired.
Well, I think the evidence of that is really, really clear, Larry, because when you've done more than the average bear's worth of collaborations.
Oh, a lot, yeah.
And in every collaborative novel that you've done, because I read the reviews, and very often within the reviews of your various collaborations, you see people say, oh, yeah, this still felt like a Larry Correa novel.
Yeah, well, because I actually, unlike a lot of senior authors, I actually work. I don't just phone it in, and I put equal work into mm-hmm. collaboration. But the other part is, I mean, I think it's kind of like when you go, if you follow food, okay, I'm a food guy. I love food, right?
You love all foods.
I love all foods. And good food, bad food, whatever it may be. And there's genres of food, right? There's genres of food. Yeah, within those genres of food, there's subgenres of food, and there's certain cooks that have certain things. They have a certain flavor. They have a certain thing that they go to, and people go back to that cook. There's certain restaurants.
Yep.
There's certain dishes that are prepared one way by one guy and one way. And none of them are necessarily right or wrong, but you kind of get to know the flavor.
Well, this was like when we were in Vegas several months ago.
We tried all the burger places.
We were comparing all the burger places. comparing Gordon Ramsay burger to Guy Fieri burger to other burger.
Bobby Flay burger.
I mean, we were comparing them all, right?
We did. We ate all we ate all the fancy big name chef burgers and compared them all. Yeah.
Turns out they're all actually pretty good.
And they're all actually pretty good. I mean, to be fair, they were actually pretty good. The Guy Fieri burger was shockingly good. That was really good. But
Gordon Ramsay won.
Oh, the Gordon Ramsay burger was actually awesome.
It was really good.
They do the thing where they fry it in butter, and they just keep pouring butter over the top of it.
Oh my goodness, those burgers
are
good.
Yeah, super good. Anyway.
Point is.
They're all burgers.
Yeah.
Those are all burgers. Those are all within the burger genre. Mm-hmm. But they're all wildly divergent burgers. And they were all actually good in different ways. And actually, some people wouldn't like some of them because it wouldn't be to their taste.
100%.
So when you're going cross-genre, or where you're going and you're experimenting in a new genre, be yourself. Have your take on that genre. So even though people have come before you and kind of established the ground rules of what the audience expects in that genre, you don't need to be entirely bound by that. I mean, you can break a lot of stuff. Son of the Black Sword breaks one of the primarily big rules of epic fantasy, and that epic fantasy is supposed to be languid. It's supposed to be like fluffy. I mean, like we got to talk about what's everybody's dress look like, and what's the architecture look like, and let's talk about the trees.
I was about to say treatsies on food, but I'm like, but wait, we just talked about how we love food so much.
But that's not in the book. Ashok eats noodles and whatever, it's and he's fuel. Good. It's fuel for killing.
Yeah,
and he hates fish. Okay, but that's part of it. But the thing is,
why he and I get along.
But one of the fundamental rules of this big genre is you write these big fat books full of turgid slowness, right?
Yep.
I just don't. I can't. I'm not wired that way.
Well, and
so you know, mine are plotted more like thrillers.
Yeah, like thrillers. You know, David Gemmell's stuff I think is a really good example of this because it's always moving forward.
Yeah.
Like, and not at a slow pace.
No.
You know, I was just reading Howard Andrew Jones's first.
Brilliant dude.
And the way he structured his is really interesting because it's effectively connected short stories that are progressing the story forward.
Yeah. He went old school pulpiness on that.
But I don't know that every writer can pull that off, but he does.
Howard's brilliant.
And it's awesome. He did. He's doing such a great job. I think I'm just going to repeat kind of what the latter half of the question that Kip asked. And that's that this is what short stories are for.
Oh, that's a great way to dabble in a genre without having
practice.
To.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't mean And I don't mean the short stories that you and I end up writing these days, which are 7 to 10,000 words.
Yeah. Well, right? I mean, a short story, you're investing an amount of time that's a fraction of what you would invest in a novel.
Yeah.
And it enables you to get a lot of it out of your system and see, do you even enjoy working mm-hmm. in that genre? You might not like it.
And that's happened to me.
Yeah.
That's happened to me. Like I'll have written a lot of times, and I've been very clear about this, a lot of times I write short stories just as experimentation and training ground, just to see if I even like that world. Do yeah. I actually like this character? Because in my head, it seemed fine.
Mm-hmm.
But once I start getting on paper, I'm like,
nah,
screw this guy.
Yeah.
You know, that was actually one of my worries about writing Werewolf Cop. I'm like, okay.
Well, because you thought about it a lot.
Because I've thought about it so much. And then I wrote the first short story. And when I was done with it, I was more amped than ever, actually.
Well, plus the short story too, you're not as locked in yet. You can be a little more free flowing, and you're just telling a few scenes, mm-hmm. really.
Well, and that's the thing. Just write a scene.
Yeah. See how it feels. So like say you want to play in romance, go write a romance scene.
Yeah. I did.
Yeah.
I literally did that when in our L5R fan fiction. Yeah. I wrote romance.
It was great. We found out
just because
Brad Torgerson
turns really out Brad Torgerson really gets there.
Brad Torgerson will go full sexy. And to an uncomfortable degree.
Yes. but you know, look, if you want to get better at action, write that. If you want to write something psychological horror, well, just go write a scene. You know, watch some old Hitchcock. And then write a scene.
Yep.
Find out what tension is. Figure out when you're going back and doing that research on whatever genre it is, what is it within there that makes it what it is, and how can you use that to your advantage?
Absolutely.
All right. That's a long answer to your question, Kip. Hope it helps. And to all you other listeners out there, hope it helps. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got a couple other questions. We'll be right back.
A half-century-old curse lies over the small community of Bridgewater ever since Sarah Chase died in a car accident during a teen angst-driven game of chicken back in 1962. She perished in the backseat of a 1961 Impala, accompanied by a group of boys who called themselves the Big Four. She screamed as the car careened through a guardrail and plunged into the icy river water beneath. The four boys survived. Sarah did not. Teenagers still race and party at the Milvian Bridge, where Sarah's car went over, especially on the anniversary of her death, in hopes of catching a glimpse of her unsettled ghost. But the partying teenagers of Bridgewater don't know that in life, Sarah belonged to a group of teenage girls who practiced witchcraft. They don't know that Sarah seeks to use her powers from the grave to avenge her unrequited vendetta. They don't know that Stan Corliss, the driver of the Impala that terrible night and the unpronounced protector of Bridgewater, has passed away, freeing Sarah to unleash her anger. Dead Girl by Craig Nybo is available on Amazon and is free for Kindle Unlimited subscribers. Pick up your copy today.
All right, everybody. Welcome back. Okay. During the break, we were debating on which of the questions to do and in which order. And one of them, as always happens, inevitably spawned its own episode. So we're going to do that one later. this is what happens.
We started looking at it. We're like, we're not going to answer this in like a few minutes.
No. Or, you know, it's funny, right? Like, I think right at the very beginning, when we were doing when we very first started the podcast, Larry, one of our very first episodes was the concept of idea management. And how inspiration stuff comes from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of what happens sometimes when we go through questions.
Supporter questions. Oh my gosh. Because
we
times,
get it and we're like, oh, you know what? That's a whole thing.
A lot of times it's stuff I do that I don't think about. Uh-huh. And so then all of a sudden somebody asks me to quantify what it is that I'm doing. And I have to actually stop and think about it.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for that. You're forcing us to be more analytical.
Well, and it's good too, right? Someone once asked, I think it was in an interview I did with one of our dojo guys, Matt Bowman. He asked about what I liked best about doing the writer dojo stuff and how it's helped me. Because obviously at this point we've had enough enough sources say that this has really helped them. But it's interesting when you and I and producer Jack, when we sit back and we think about it, a lot of the advice we give, I actually get a lot of value out of it, just because it's one thing to have it in my brain, and then it's another thing to say it out loud.
You can't really explain a concept if you don't understand the concept.
And so the more and more I think that you and I explain things and talk about things and have to think about how we're going to quantify them for an audience, I think that actually helps us.
It's helped me to articulate a lot of the stuff that I do subconsciously, to actually understand what it is I'm doing and then to look for problems with that.
Yeah, 100%. All right. One of those things, Larry, is, this is from, not actually sure if this is one of our supporters or not, but anyway, person asked, and you and I've talked about this before. We love this topic. What are some tips for making female characters strong and competent without it turning into a girl power annoyance?
Now that's an interesting one.
Because this is perhaps one of our biggest issues, especially when we're looking at things like how characters are presented in film and TV. The idea of well-rounded, rootable, like you can root for these characters, you understand the characters, you like these characters, love these characters, or love to hate these characters in a good way. Hollywood and them have gotten completely away with this.
Yeah. This is a hot button topic right now. And first off, I'd recommend go back and listen to our episodes on writing characters.
Because in those episodes, we're not like, here is how you write a female character.
No,
here's how you write them. No. Here's how you write a character.
Well, and like just recently we had an episode about fleshing, bringing them to life, characters to life. And this applies to males and females. The problem is, and why this is a hot button topic right now, is a lot of people have taken stereotypes. They've taken stereotypes of the strong woman and they've made them that they're commandments.
Yeah.
That if you're going to have a strong female character, she must do this, this, and this. The problem with that is the stereotypes don't actually feel right. They don't feel organic. They tend to feel shoehorned in. Anytime you write according to a checklist like that, you are going to feel unnatural to the audience.
Yep.
And that's your problem. So if you have it so that your strong female character is strong in comparison to all the other male characters, you make all the male characters dumb. That's even worse.
That's it right there.
Finn and Poe and you know what I mean? They're just dumb. It's just lazy. It's dumb.
Well, it was like, I liked Infinity War and Endgame, those movies. Mm-hmm. Overall, I liked them, except for Captain Marvel.
Yeah, so Captain Marvel to me,
she was shoehorned in.
Is made of wood and has...
Makes no sense.
And is just super powerful and we're supposed to like her because she's really powerful, I guess.
Yeah, but we have no frame of reference for her. It's just, oh, by the way.
Yeah.
She's way more powerful than all these guys. It's like, but she's not.
But that's not interesting either. I mean, just power on its own is a number. It's like you got a number on a character sheet. She's got a 28 in strength. Okay, what does that mean to me? Doesn't mean anything. I mean, Scarlett Johansson playing Black Widow was a normal human other than sexy kung fu, but way more interesting and a way more popular character. And
Scarlet Witch within the same movies is like the direct opposite contrast.
And actually flawed.
Very
extremely flawed and emotional. Mm-hmm. She's allowed to be emotional.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you want to write strong characters, go back, listen to these episodes and apply what we talked about because this is male or female. If you want to make a character strong, show us why they're strong. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that means hurting them. They have to try. They have to fail. They have to struggle. They're going to struggle in different ways. They're going to be human. Mm-hmm. Even if you're writing aliens, you're still writing for a human audience.
But that's fine because that's the whole point of Superman, right? Like you are contextualizing more or less a god. But you're doing it within through the lens of humanity.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? The original Gal Gadot Wonder Woman, actually, I thought...
The original was really good.
Yeah, I thought did a pretty good job. Because here she was. She was way more interesting than Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
And once again, superhuman, crazy background. But they actually humanized her.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, too, was the relationship she had with people around her. Chris Pine, they didn't make Chris Pine a bumbling idiot to make her better.
No.
Chris Pine just played Chris Pine because Chris Pine always plays Chris Pine.
Yes.
I think if you were to meet Chris Pine in real life, he'd probably be a lot like Chris Pine in the movies.
He'd be very similar.
Call it a hunch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But when you look at that, though, that's a strong female character, but it doesn't degrade everybody else around it. So people are happy. I mean, they're content with it. Now, I don't know about the sequel. I never heard anything good about the sequel. I didn't watch it.
Well, again, it was cardboard cutouts for all villains. You know, again, they lost the point of making us care about the characters in an organic way.
Yeah. Part of the problem with this issue is it's become a political issue. Mm-hmm. Where audiences have rebelled against stale, crappy writing in movies and in video games and in books. And because of that, the people who produce the stale crap have flipped it into like a misogynistic thing. I was like, oh, you only hate strong women, which is, we know is nonsense because
we grew up on Alien.
Yeah. We grew up on Ellen Ripley. We grew up on Sarah Connor.
Yep.
You know, I mean, come on. And I critique this writing and people say, you hate strong women. I wrote Faye Vieira. Okay. And this is a teenage girl character.
Yeah.
And you'd be pretty hard pressed, or the women of Monster Hunter. I mean, there's not a shortage of strong female characters in Monster Hunter. But what do I do with all those? They're people.
Mm-hmm.
They're human beings. They face challenges. They have an actual personality with pros and cons and flaws and beliefs and opinions. And they're human. Mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to. Make them human. They can be powerful. They can be great, but they've got to be people.
I remember, oh man, this would have been maybe 10 years ago. I was at a convention and on this panel, I don't remember who all was on this panel except Robin Hobb, who she's really, really great. Really, really nice person. Good writer. I mean, kind of a famous author for fantasy, obviously, you know, Fool's Apprentice and all that crap. Really, really cool. I remember on this panel, someone asked the question, like, it had to do with writing characters that were male or female. How do you know that this character needs to be female or male? And she just says, and what she said was, it doesn't matter. She's like, if the character is really, really good, like really good, them being male or female is kind of ancillary.
Yeah. It's just part of who they are.
But she followed up with saying it was why. So then the question is, why am I making them male? Why am I making them female? And I think that's an interesting question to ask.
If you're making them anything to check a box or to meet a quota,
mm-hmm.
Reader's going to sense it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, here's what I do, because I tend to approach things a little wonky when it comes to characters. And maybe this is because of horror type stuff, but whatever the fear is that these characters have, sometimes certain fears mean more to a female than they do to a male,
mm-hmm.
or to a male than a female. Right? Like in my short story collection, I have a short story. I think it's called Fear, but it's about a woman who just had a baby and who's basically, she thinks she's going through basically postpartum depression and she's freaking tired. It's only like a 1500 word story. That story would have had zero impact if it came from a dude's point of view.
Well, it's kind of like when I did Monster Hunter Guardian with Sarah Hoyt.
Yeah.
So this is a new mom who has her baby kidnapped. And it's interesting to me in the reviews, I saw a distinct subset of the reviews where people who didn't have kids or didn't like kids.
Didn't get it. No.
They still like the book. It's still a Monster Hunter novel. Still action, adventure, monsters, explosions, whatnot, gunfighting. Yeah. Supernatural stuff, but some people like, I just didn't like how she like saw this fixation on like my kid.
The rest of us who have kids are like, she didn't go far enough.
Every parent out there was like, burned the world. And, yeah. And got, it was interesting to me though, to see that cutoff. Mm-hmm. And so no matter what you do, however you structure a character, if you make them human, some people aren't going to get them.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Because real life, people don't get each other. Mm-hmm. There isn't really a universal. Any character you name, there's going to be somebody out there who doesn't like them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're never going to please everybody.
Well, seriously, name any popular character, there's going to be a subset of humanity that hates them.
Harry Dresden.
There's people who hate
Harry. There's plenty of people that hate Harry Dresden. Yeah.
Well, Harry Potter.
Harry Potter. No, legit.
Legit.
Yeah.
I mean, name any. I mean, Luke Skywalker, doesn't matter. Name mm-hmm. any Indiana Jones name. There's always going to be somebody who takes issue with mm-hmm. that super iconic character. I mean, except maybe Magnum P.I., because everybody loves Magnum.
Well, it's Tom Selleck.
And if you don't like Magnum, you can just disconnect the show now. If you don't like
Tom Selleck and his sidekick, which is his mustache, then you don't.
Yeah,
just you're not human.
Yeah, just stop listening out. Now. I can't help you.
All right. All right. So that's more or less our answer to that question. It's not, you're not, stop thinking of it as I'm writing a female character.
Yeah.
No. You're writing a character.
Yeah, you're writing a character. It happens to be strong character.
It happens to be a
female character.
Yep.
Make them human.
All right. Last question for this episode. This is from our boy, Rick. He wants to know, how do you write an introduction to an anthology or a collection? Now, we've both done this.
We have, yes. I've done this probably 5 or 6 times.
Yeah, either for our own collections or for...
Oh, I didn't think of my own stuff, yeah. Yeah,
or for anthologies that are
yep.
Made up of a bunch of different other authors. This is harder than people think it is.
I've written intros to books and I've written intros to anthologies and collections for myself and for others.
It seems way harder than it needs to be.
It actually is, because it's a writing assignment that's basically only a page or two. Okay. An intro is not long.
No, yeah. I mean, page and a half.
Yeah. I mean, what are we talking? Like 800 words, 500 words? Yeah. Not huge. I mean, maybe 1,000. I mean, not a big...
Well, when you were doing the new introductions for the limited editions of Hard Magic and that
trilogy,
yeah, 750 words.
Okay, yeah. So I try to keep them all about the same size. Mm-hmm. So about a page and a half.
Yeah.
In print. It's actually hard. Okay, yeah. There's a couple ways to do it. And the way as I've done it is sometimes there's a story to be told that sets it. So like if I'm doing a intro for like a special edition, sometimes for some anthologies, there's a story behind why this thing exists.
Yeah.
My job as the guy giving the intro is I can provide that story.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do it in a short, pithy, interesting way. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of room. People aren't picking up the anthology to hear me bloviate.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is if it's like a theme anthology.
You gotta explain what that theme is for people.
Like how did it come together? So like when I'm doing the intro for like Noir Fatale, those three, so Casey and I both had an intro as mm-hmm. the editor. So each of us talked a little bit about the background of how the anthology came to be. And we talked about the theme and like what the theme meant to us.
Yeah.
You know, and I've done intros. I did an intro for Hillbilly for Tales from the Trailer Park, you know, and why did they ask me? Because I was the guy with the Trailer Park Elves who kind of introduced, honestly, really in the genre, like the whole redneck fantasy trope.
Redneck urban fantasy trope.
Yeah. So when they did a anthology of basically redneck trailer park fantasy stories, they came to me to write the intro because I'm the guy that invented the trailer park elves. And so I talked a little bit about that and where that idea came from. And then the fun that's been had with that theme since. And that just provided intro to these stories that other people then told.
Yeah. I don't think there's really a wrong answer here other than...
Don't be boring.
Don't be boring.
Yeah. I read some boring intros.
Oh, man.
I read some intros for anthologies I skipped. Like I started reading it and it was just boring and I skipped it and went ahead to the stories.
Yeah. I don't... For me, it all comes down to why does this collection exist? and I want to tell you why.
Yeah, I mean, if there's an interesting story about how it came to be, then that's great.
And I want to say why it's cool.
People love it. You know, one of the things I like in short stories that a lot of, or you see it in collections more than anthologies. So, I did this with Target Rich Environment. At the end of the story or before the story, I would put a little thing.
Yes.
Explaining where the story came from.
Yes, yes. Because you and I talked about this.
I love that.
Yeah. I picked up a collection from, it actually might have been a Lansdale collection from Subterranean Press back in like 2006. And it was before I even met you. And I was reading it. And at the end of every story, there was, here's how I got this idea.
Mm-hmm. I found that fascinating.
And I love that.
I love when authors do that. And I think I remember one, I think it might have been Orson Scott Card had a collection of short stories like that. And he had each one. To me, the story of how he came up with the story or the backstory of the story was super oftentimes neat. More interesting than the story. Don't get me wrong, he's a great short fiction author. But I'm just saying, I love that. So when I did Target Rich Environment, I very much wanted to do the same thing. I just love that idea.
And I did the same thing with Hellhounds.
Yeah. It's right? Just, it's fun. It's fun to add that. So I think the opening is you're just kind of doing that mm-hmm. for the whole project.
Yes.
Instead of the individual stories therein.
Yeah. Now I've seen people do it where the introduction to that, especially if it's a collection where there are many stories from a similar point of view. Like if it's a collection from one author and they have three or four different stories in there from the same POV character, you can see an introduction that's from that point of view character. And yeah. That's fun. It's almost like it's its own little short story.
Yeah.
And that's neat too. I just think there's a lot of flexibility here, but I have a hard time with it.
I struggle.
It's hard.
I struggle with that. Okay, guys, little short things that should be easy, I struggle with so much more than books.
Yeah.
Back cover blurbs. I've talked about it on the show before. I despise writing back cover blurbs. Hey, Larry, suck. You just wrote 150,000 words of complex story.
Give me two paragraphs of why it's neat.
Give me two paragraphs of why you should buy this product. Dude,
this is the real reason why you do collaborations.
I agonize. In fact, every one of my collaborators will tell you the same thing. I always
make us do it.
I always shove that onto the collaborator. I say I'm an equal collaborator, and that is true for the actual book.
Not for the back cover blurb.
Back cover blurb, man. Okay, even all my Bayon stuff, I wrote very few of those, of my back cover blurbs.
It's hard, man. I mean,
I struggle with it. I really do.
You know, and it's... it's all kind of in a similar mindset, the back cover blurb, the intro to a collection, or even to a book. And I remember for Residue and for Parasite, and then for Catalyst when it comes out later on here, I was giving the descriptions over to Mike Rothman, and he's like, yeah, that's cute, Steve. Here it is, it's better. And he sent it back to me, and I'm like, oh yeah, that really is better. I suck at this.
Some people have a gift for that. And I think that's awesome. And I respect that because I don't. And
yeah, I'm not that guy.
So Rick, if you are a guy that can write good intros and good blurbs, then more power to you, man.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think it's just, you're going to have to play with it.
Well, and ask if it's for if you are writing like you did with Hillbilly, right? I would just ask them, well, what is it you're looking for?
Yeah, honestly, if you're doing it for somebody else, if you're doing it for yourself, obviously it's different. But if you're doing it for a publisher,
just ask what they want.
Yeah, what are you guys looking for? What do you want? Is there like a cool story that you want me to tell, or is there like the theme you want me to hit or explain, mm-hmm. or where this came from?
Yep.
You know, by all means, take requests.
Yep.
That, and honestly, I find having that little bit of thing to focus on helps immensely.
Because yeah. I can just tailor it around that.
Yeah, you say, Larry, go write a 10,000-word short story about topic X. Okay.
I'm on.
I'm off. Yeah. I'm no problem, man. And I'll have that to you in a couple days.
Yeah.
You asked me to do a back cover blurb for a book that I've already written? I'll screw that noise. Or ask me to do an intro to, like, So people ask me to do intros all the time, and I don't think they realize it, like...
It's hard.
For me, I'm so... at it.
Oh my goodness.
And I almost always say yes, but then I agonize. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for you today. There are some other questions that have been asked of us, but almost all of those are going to turn into full episodes. So, again, for you supporters, if you have questions, don't be shy, shoot them our way. Even if it's something that maybe we've already addressed before, it's fine. Ask the question. Because maybe, we can try to hit it in a different, from a different angle.
We're also, we've been doing this long enough that we have so many episodes that I have actually forgotten topics that we've talked about.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, opinions and takes and angles, like that all changes over time.
Well, I'll learn something new.
Yeah.
Yeah. We rail on the show. Don't get stagnant.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Again, thank you guys for listening. We appreciate you all. This is Rider Dojo. We'll see you on the next one.
Rider Dojo is Steve Diamond and Larry Correa. Produced by Jack Wilder and Bear and Hair Studios. Theme song, Word Mercenaries by Craig Nybo. New episodes come out every Wednesday wherever you stream your content. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can help support us by going to anchor.fm/Rider Dojo. By leaving a 5-star rating and review, and by helping to spread the word. To advertise on the Rider Dojo, email ads@writerdojo.com. All questions and comments can be emailed to questions@writerdojo.com.
Turns out there's no allergies in the middle of the ocean.